Hi, everyone. It's Chelsea. Today, Dana and I are joined by Amy Kenny for a very long overdue conversation about disability and the church. Amy is a disabled scholar, writer, and advocate. And today we're talking about her book, My Body is Not a Prayer Request. This really mixes her own personal story with humor and theology as she invites faith communities to rethink their unintentional ableism and to learn from the embodied wisdom of disabled people. We really encourage you to pick up this hard copy of this book or an audio version. There are discussion questions and practical tips that you can do at the end of each chapter. So grab a group of people, grab some friends, and dive in and really just spend some time in this long overdue conversation about disability and the church. If you want to find out more about Amy, you can visit amy-kenny.com. We hope you enjoy this conversation.
Hi, everybody out there. It's Dana, and we are just very excited and honored today to have Amy Kenny with us. And she is the author of My Body is Not a Prayer Request, Disability Justice in the Church. And we are very much looking forward to this conversation. We want to dig in and just see where things take us. And so with that, Amy, just thank you so much for being here. We're very excited to hear from you and thank you for your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
The first thing is, before we get into a lot of details, there might be some people who are listening to this who haven't read the book yet, or maybe are debating, okay, I've just started to get into it. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview, just a quick overview of some of the core things that you would say are the focus of this book?
The book is about my experience as a disabled woman growing up in the church. And as the title suggests, it's a really loving clapback to a lot of the unsolicited prayers that I received from folks around and about my disabled body mind. And it's an invitation to the church to really rethink some of what we've been taught about disability.
Excellent. Okay.
So the book has been out just over a year. What has the feedback been like? What has the response been? Have you, you know, kind of just leave it there. Like what has been the feedback so far?
There's been a lot of me too from disabled folks saying, thank you for saying it, or something very similar happened to them growing up in church or in churches now. And there's been a lot of processing from folks who haven't really thought about disability before, and this has given them a new window into our community. And of course, you know, with sprinkles of you're a heretic every now and again as well.
Lovely. Has there been anything that's pleasantly surprised you that sticks out in your mind?
It surprised me that people are reading it. I didn't expect for people to read it. I joined a writer's group to write about my own experience as a way of processing it. And in that group was very encouraged, and then fast forward to the book being published. So that people are engaging with it has surprised me.
That's great. That's wonderful.
I found the book through a friend who at their church, they were doing an audit of the hymns that they sing and changing some words. So Be Thou My Vision, they changed to Wisdom. And when she was telling me this, I was like, yeah. You don't see what you don't see, right? You don't know what you don't know. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I once was blind, but now I see, like just all of these things. And so she recommended the book, and I was just a little bit, to be super honest, felt shame that I had not ever thought about that experience before. And so background, I was clergy for 12 years in the Methodist church, and just realized all the times that I probably overlooked or didn't see or didn't even pay attention to the ways in which the church could be better in that particular regard. And so the book has really opened my eyes a lot, just to all the ways that, you know, we want to be an inclusive church. We want to be interconnected. We want to be one body. And yet we've left so many people out just based on ignorance, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that has been a really common experience for people, just ignorance and not realizing. And I have a lot of elasticity and grace for that. And I hope that, you know, now that we know better, we do better. And I think too that there's reason for not knowing, which is that disabled folks have been excluded from so many different communities, the church included. And many church leaders fought against the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990 passing. So churches do not have to be, they're not legally required to be accessible. And so that impacts who's a part of a church community. And my hope is that the book would make it clear to folks who maybe haven't thought about the disability community before that the non-disabled person cannot say to the disabled person, I have no need of you. You know, how ridiculous would that be? We're all one body. And our gifts and our stories and our body minds are valuable to the church, whether they include us or not.
Have you found churches or denominations coming to, like, you know, Chelsea, I've been talking about, like, there's the individual and then there's really the system. And when I think about the church, I think of a system. I think of a denomination as a system, an institution. Have you found feedback from almost the system to be different than from individuals? Or have you found like there's no feedback from the system?
That's a great question. I think that something I'm asked a lot is, basically, which denomination is the worst? You know, people phrase it better than that most of the time, but basically that's a question I've been asked quite a few times. And I think what's happening there is people are hoping that the one that they call themselves a part of isn't as bad as, you know, that fill in the blank, that one over there, that's worse to disabled folks. I think that the engagement that I've had with the system of the church, as you're delineating, is other folks trying to kind of point to, well, that denomination is worse, or that denomination does this. We don't do that. We're not as bad as that. Gasp. And then I think the other way that I've engaged with the system and the book is through different denominations doing a book study or a Bible study or a small group or a life group or, you know, some form of engaging with the book together and either inviting me to do a talk or a connection with them or not. And I've found out about it that way. So I think that I have certainly heard more stories at the individual level than the systemic. And the stories I have heard at the systemics have sometimes been around wanting to view our system as better somehow.
I don't think that surprises me at all.
I was surprised to read in the book that religious leaders were so adamantly against the Disability Act. That's just not something that, I mean, when you think of clergy or the church, you want to be the exact opposite of that. Why do you think there was so much resistance, or like, what do you think the pushback was?
Money. There's one of the documents says that it's too expensive to make churches accessible. I think that that's an invitation for us to think about what we think the church is for and how it should be including everyone. But also it's an invitation for us to really examine what budget line items we don't push back on. You know, there's often churches will have elaborate sound systems or lights and a whole show, and that isn't pushed back on in the same way as making a bathroom accessible or making parking accessible or having Braille or non-triggering lights or making sure that there's an ASL interpreter. So I think to all of that, I would really say, you know, camel meet eye of needle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, the money, obviously, this even comes into play when we talk about our medical system too, and just being in a capitalistic, you know, country. And yet I did the same thing. I was talking to my husband about the Disability Act and that a lot of, you know, spiritual leaders, church leaders, Christian leaders were against it. And he was just so surprised. And I'm surprised that they wouldn't have tried to find some compromise in some way, shape, or form versus just completely coming out against it. So it was a learning experience for me. Thank you. Yeah.
So when you're in the starting to write this book in your group and you decide, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do this, who was your audience? Was it two people it's church focused. There's a lot of, but like, who are you hoping would pick it up and read it and engage with it?
The audience is anyone in church. And I think my definition of chach is very broad and open. You know, chach is a group of folks who are getting together, doing, you know, being community to one another and doing the work. And chach can sometimes be found in a sanctuary and sometimes be found in a park or a laundromat, or a living room. So I think anyone who considers themselves a part of chach is the audience. Specifically, non-disabled folks who don't seem to often really think about us or our experience, and even the response of being surprised at so much of the material in the book really demonstrates just how few disability stories and histories are told.
And you do, you know, you use your story, it's your story, and you talk a lot about your experience in churches, in different churches, with individuals. And, you know, one thing that I kept thinking to myself is, why does she stay in church? Is she still in church? Because it's like, at some point I'm like, are you just not like, I'm done with this.
So just run them over with my scooter. Yeah. What a question. Yeah. I think that they, and the they here is anyone who is, you know, in the book or in my life who has either unknowingly or purposely perpetuated ableism against me in some kind of way, they don't get to take Jesus from me. Mm. They don't get to determine who Jesus is. They don't get to take away with the core spiritual lies that I'm broken or less than or defective somehow. They don't get to take away from the truth that my disabled body is fearfully and wonderfully made. And I have a lot of space for disabled folks who choose whatever path is right for them. And I think also that it is a sacred act to have space and to have boundaries, you know, for our own healing and for our own ability to, you know, to not become cynical and to not become jaded. And even with all of that, it doesn't smell like Jesus to say that's on Jesus for how people have treated me, because I grew up in a household where I was taught that we were all made in the image of God, and I had the audacity to believe it.
I was just going to ask you that, because in the book, you're talking about some of the procedures and how young you were and the bold decisions you made of making certain decisions about your body. And so were you always that bold bold and right to say, this is my body and it's beautifully made? Was it a process? Was it a shifting kind of consciousness of reading scripture through the lens in which you talk about in the book? How'd that all play out?
You'd probably have to ask my parents, but if I was always that bold, they'd probably say yes. it was definitely a journey, yes. I don't think I had the language that I have now when I was 11. You know, I don't think I had it at 16. I don't think I had it at 20. I think that now I know how to share the inward feelings that I had at those ages. I can remember really vividly and viscerally how it felt to be prayed for week in and week out, being told that I was corrupt or broken or crooked or, you know, insert other scary word here. And I remember it feeling wrong. I don't think that I knew how to explain why it was wrong. And over time, I started to notice how beautifully bent and crooked the community of creation is. And I noticed how bendy trees are and how, you know, how so many animals have qualities that we would deem disabilities if they were human. And I started to think, well, if I can see the radiance in a tree or in a kangaroo or a shark, how come I can't see that in myself? And I think I could all along. It was just naming that I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And then, of course, going on a journey to try to name that for others too.
Are you at a place now where you found a spiritual home that does offer a lot of the things that you've talked about in this book, or is it still a search for you?
I wish I was. Yeah, it's still a search. It's a courageous and vulnerable place to share with people constantly. You know, oh, hey, whoops, that was ableism, or oh, that didn't feel great when we did that, or, you know, that song we sang that equated not walking with something sinning, that was damaging to me. And it's, I think, a lot of emotional labor to constantly do the work of choosing when you're going to say something, choosing which, you know, battles to fight, so to speak. And I think a lot of that is the kind of emotional and mental labor that no one really sees.
You've used this term a couple of times, and I just want to, for our audience, define it when we're using it. But can you tell us what ableism is, and what do you mean when you're using that term, just so we're clear moving forward?
Ableism is any discrimination against disabled folks, but it's much broader than discrimination against disabled folks, as in calling us a slur or saying something derogatory about our body minds. It's a system that creates a hierarchy of bodies. It values some body minds over others. It says that the thinner you are, the whiter you are, the more physically fit you are, the more non-disabled you are, the more cishet you are, that is somehow better than and more praiseworthy than any other body type or way of existing in the world. And hopefully we can see how that intersects with so many other systems of oppression. And it creates a system where none of us can flourish, because we're constantly measuring up to an ideal that doesn't exist. You know, our body minds need rest. We don't earn that through hustle culture. We just need rest. Some days I need help getting dressed. Other days I don't. On all days, I am worthy of belonging and care. And ableism is the lie that says any different.
Thank you very much for sharing that. I think that's very helpful, certainly for me when I read about it in the book and the way you defined it, and then for the audience. And I think about, we're coming back to this individual and the system. How do the two, you know, because the system seems to me so overwhelming. I don't, you know, whether it's, you know, the system of ableism, the system of the church, and is your thought or your experience to try and connect with as many individuals, educate as many individuals, and then through that, does the system start to slowly move?
I sure hope so. The system is us. Mm. We uphold it. You know, these ideas that disabled bodies are somehow less than or negative, that's a social construct. And we're its construction workers. We can construct something different. I think the built environment is a great example of that. You know, it wouldn't be difficult navigating the world on wheels if we hadn't bothered to put stairs everywhere. It's that we've put stairs that make things difficult using a wheelchair. That's sort of the classic example of the social model of disability. But there are a number of different examples in thinking about how the lighting that we choose, the pace that we operate at, the ways that we communicate with one another, the styles, the interactions that we have, that if we chose individually and collectively to create a culture of access, then these ableist systems would cease to exist. I understand how overwhelming it can be, you know, to deal with this every day and in every micro decision of my life, how I move about the world, how I get somewhere, whether or not I can get into the place, if I can get into the place, whether there's a place for me to pee, you know, all of those kind of questions that are endless. And I do have hope, and hope against hope, that we can change that system. And I think it happens at one conversation at a time.
I love in, I think it was in the Justice chapter, about, you talk about the vibrant goodness between us. And instead of investing in our own personal well-being, that we invest in this, I wrote it down, I want to get it right, mutual flourishing. And I just love that idea. And I'm wondering if you've seen this done well on either individual levels or collective levels? Like, has anybody figured out what that looks like yet?
I have experienced it in a number of different settings. I think that it happens when we are caring for one another, and can happen in taking a meal to one another when someone doesn't have the spoons to make it for themselves, or when someone's having a hard week, whether they're disabled or not. You know, who doesn't love a nice meal? it feeds our body minds, but it also feeds our souls, I think, and nourishes us in a really powerful way. I think it has happened in my life when folks have rallied together to drive me to various doctor's appointments or medical appointments, recognizing that it's exhausting going to so many, and supporting me and at the time my family in doing that. I think it happens on an individual level between two people, three people, four people. And then once it becomes the furniture of our minds, you know, once it becomes commonplace to us, then we start doing it without even recognizing. And then I think that's what creates this co-flourishing.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the medical institution, the medical system that we have here in this country. You talk about your experience, some of your experiences with that. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was trying to understand and wrestle with is, how do we, and I don't know, I'm going to be honest, I don't know a lot about other countries and their different systems of health care. I mean, I have a general idea, but not nearly as much as I do in this country. And I think about the innovation that we often create, and people are always, oh, there's cost to this innovation. And yet also medical care is so expensive in this country. And so what is your experience or thoughts or ideas on, one, how do you find that connection or that intersection between we want to innovate and we want to have accessible Medicare or medical facilities here? And what does it look like in other countries, if you've had any other experience, or are there better models?
Yes, there are better models. I recently read a Harvard study that said that 80% of medical professionals say that disabled folks do not have a good quality of life. And that's how many admit it to our face. You know, so imagine what they say behind our backs. That's going to affect the interventions that they offer us. That's going to affect their understanding about our pain, our experiences, our needs, and how they can use their expertise and power to meet those needs. And of course, you know, none of us are just one identity. So, you know, it's, we're also thinking about class, race, gender, sexuality, you know, every time we're thinking about how we are engaging with these systems, such as the medical system. I think something that's really crucial is the disability rights slogan of nothing about us without us. There are so many disability dongles out there that someone who's non-disabled has created, and it's something no one really asked for, and they're really proud of it and excited. I think a great example is a stair-climbing wheelchair that I've seen created a few different times in different iterations. And it's, you know, $50,000, and look at this, it climbs stairs very slowly. All you have to do is wait 3 hours and have $50,000 in extra cash. Well, pass. You know, what about everyone else who needs to get to wherever we're going? That helps one individual instead of creating a community where we can co-flourish. So I think that's one of the most important things, is that the medical system and the church and really every system should have disabled folks helping make the decisions and decide and give input on our experience.
One thing I think was a big realization for me, and again, this goes back to like just kind of being ashamed I didn't think of it before, but the amount, and you were kind of just talking about it, the amount of extra time, emotional energy, finances, like that's all on top of a different, like an experience that you're already having. Like it costs you more to be human than it costs me to be human based on all of those things. And I never had put together the cost, not just financially, but like in all the other ways, right? And you do try to think about like, how do you even that out? And I mean, you've given us some examples, but it just, I had never, that was a big takeaway for me, just realizing the extraness of everything between our experiences.
Yeah, thanks. The crip tax, which is the, you know, the money that disabled folks pay just to survive because we need mobility aids or different assistive technologies, or, you know, just the, it costs extra to be disabled to our actual wallets, you know, estimates that disabled folks spend somewhere between $10,000 and $30,000 a year on top of what non-disabled folks spend. And that's every year. And no one takes our receipts for that, you know. And then on top of that, as you're suggesting, there's the emotional labor. There's, you know, someone says a disability slur in a meeting or, you know, in a group chat, and you have to sort of weigh, okay, am I going to say the thing? You know, how much power and privilege do I have here? What will be the effect if I don't? How many other things have I said just today that, you know, and don't want to always be kind of the irritant in the group chat, you know, or in the meeting or in the friend group? And then how much of our experience folks have just never even thought of? And so it's constantly educating people about what it is to be disabled, and that, you know, no, we're not all an inspirational commercial or Forrest Gump, and you can just sort of yell at us to run and we will. And so I think that all of that does add up, and it can be really exhausting when folks are unaware of those different types of costs.
Yeah, I thought one of the parts in the book that sticks out for me is the story that you tell about you were supposed to go out with your friends, and you could not go out with them, and they're texting you. You're like, do you text them back? What do you say? And I'd never thought about that. And you're trying to think, do I really tell them how I feel? Because I'm not fine. And yet if I tell them I'm not fine, can they handle that? Those are my words. Obviously yours were much more eloquent, but I just thought I wouldn't even have thought about that. I would have been that part like, okay, I hope you have a great evening. I hope you'll be better. What is that? Who says this?
Yeah. And that's all within the space of text message conversation, which is rapid and, you know, a small amount of time. And it's that juggling of, well, if I say something, am I going to be too much? You know, do people want to be around someone with all this baggage? You know, all of those questions that you're constantly asking and renegotiating. And even if the friend responds with a lot of kindness and wants to grow and learn, just having to explain sometimes feels really exhausting.
Yeah, that was very helpful to read
What was helpful in your language, and you just mentioned it a couple minutes ago, but the spoons, like I'm out of spoons. And I'm wondering if you could explain that a little bit, because that was helpful too.
Spoon theory comes to us from Christine Michaudière. Well, I'm not saying it today, I guess. But she comes up with this theory about what it's like to live with chronic illness or chronic pain, and is trying to explain it to a friend who does not use spoons and or have any chronic illness or chronic pain. And she equates a spoon to the amount of energy it takes to do a task. And the spoons fluctuate from day to day. And, you know, one day you have a lot of spoons, another day you don't. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. And it's a way of helping someone understand what it's like to live with chronic pain or chronic fatigue or chronic illness, where we often don't know why one day we can do something that the next day we can't. It's constantly fluctuating. And folks will ask, well, how come you can't do that today? Or you could do that yesterday. And they're not meaning to be accusatory, but it still feels like that. And it's a helpful way for people to understand that we don't have the same amount of energy every single day.
In the book, you say so many of us have been taught to understand disability from a loss model. And I really appreciated your reframe. You go on to say, wheelchairs are freedom. And I just thought, could you share a little bit more about how that's shown up for you in your life? Because I do think we've definitely gone back to this idea like, oh, it's a loss model. And you're like, no, let's reframe this.
Wheelchairs are freedom. When I'm using my wheelchair, I can go faster than someone walking. I zip past you, wind in my hair, lightning bolts at my side without anyone, you know, realizing who's there or what's happening. I can zip around quickly and with ease. It's fluid and I have the image of kind of water caressing a riverbank is how it feels to glide throughout the world. Walking is clunky and awkward and people stump and it feels heavy and a little bit uncomfortable, right? You're constantly striking the ground with your own body. I don't have to worry about that. I get to glide through the world. And every time I talk about wheelchairs being freedom, someone is shocked because we've been taught that wheelchairs are a prison or that they are confining people. And my experience and many of my disabled friends' experience has been the exact opposite. I really appreciate the wisdom of my niece and nephew who are young. And I overheard them say to their friends one day when I was watching them at a game, that's my aunt. She doesn't have to walk. She gets to ride around in a cool scooter. Yeah. And if only we could all really follow the wisdom of children in understanding, that's right. I do get to ride around in a cool scooter.
Yeah. It was so great the way you wrote that. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
This one, now that the book's been out for a little over a year, and now that it's been out there, is there anything you would have done differently? Would you have added anything? Would you have taken away anything?
I'm not sure I have enough distance from it yet to know the answer to that. Yeah. Ask me in 5 years, I think. And then the answer might be different. I wrote from a scar and not an open wound. And I'm very grateful to Past Amy for doing that because there were lots of stories, as you can imagine, that I could have told and I chose not to because they were still an open wound. And so I'm glad that I did that. Maybe those stories will feature in a different piece. Maybe not. Maybe they're just mine and no one else's to know. But I'm not sure if in a few years, you know, if I'll look back and think I should have done this or that differently. So stay tuned.
Did it feel therapeutic writing it?
It did. It felt like I was writing it for young Amy who didn't have the way of explaining all of this, but I think knew it kind of deep within my body mind. It felt like I was sharing so many interior moments with the world. You know, these moments between text messages, these moments on the way somewhere or negotiating what to say and when to say it and how to say it. And so much of that, as we've said, isn't visible to others. And so it felt a little bit like I have see-through skin, but in a good way, getting to show people some of my interior world.
Well, what are you working on now? Is there ways, projects that might be coming up that we can follow your career, follow what next is coming out? Or
I follow the cloud, so I don't have a plan for what I'm writing or doing next. I'm being present and listening and learning and resting. And I'm grateful for these conversations and for the opportunity to get to share this with folks. And I'll figure it out alongside you. Yeah. What's next?
Well, know that we are alongside you and we're so honored to not just read your work, but to be able to share your work and help pass along your message of, you know, what the hope that you have. Really, it's inspiring to hear your story and hear the hope that you have for the church and for people. And we're in the fight with you. So know that.
Thank you so much for putting this out there into the world. It's a gift.
Hopefully we'll have many more conversations.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, Amy.